Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear radio program. I'm your host, Susan Larison-Danz, and today we're taking on what is really quite a challenging topic, and I am hoping that we can address this from a very unique point of view, looking at different perspectives on this topic. And we're going to talk today, I have on the show today, returning after a little while, we haven't had her on in a while, Sue Elliott, who founded the Portland, Oregon meetup group, Portland Christians with Questions, is going to be talking with me very openly and honestly about the topic of a woman's right to choose, balancing that against how some view a woman's or a baby's right to life. And we're going to look at both sides of this question, and we're really going to explore what I certainly feel is a topic that is causing a lot of anguish out there for many women with multiple viewpoints. And it's something that is not often discussed in a very open and honest way. It seems that too often there are caricatures portrayed of alternative viewpoints without really looking into those viewpoints and thinking about those what certain things imply. So this is going to be an interesting, in a way, an experiment today's show to see if we can really delve into this in a way that is quite a bit different than what is often heard. We do have a chat room open during today's show if you'd like to go in there and participate in the discussion. And without further delay, I'm going to bring Sue on the show here. Here we go. Welcome, Sue. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me again.
Yes, well, this should be quite an interesting discussion, I think, because I don't know about you, Sue, but I feel that far too often, and we've had friends, we have known people on multiple, there aren't even just two sides of this issue. There are degrees of this issue. Wouldn't you say that, Sue?
Yeah, that's interesting because it was kind of going to be one of my first points, too, is that although we just see the radical extremes, if you actually talk to people outside of their the places that polarize them, usually what you have is a vast gray area in the middle, which is really where most people live. And I think I would, if I was going to have to give it a title, I would say it would be choice with limits, you know, abortion with limits, or abortion with responsibility. Might be an even looser way to put it. But yeah, I agree. It's not, you know, one extreme or the other, but that tends to be what you hear in the public arena.
And, you know, I too come from the perspective of choice with limits, and I think I also see that figuring out what those limits are is a very challenging thing for society. And, you know, right now it's up to women to decide personally what they feel comfortable with. But even, you know, legislating what those limits are is extremely challenging. And you know, I'm going to make it really clear that I am not an activist on this issue. I have never really even talked about this issue openly. I, you know, do not work for Planned Parenthood. I do not, you know, I have never really explored this openly. And I think this is part of the reason why I'm doing this show today, is because I think many women are in this position where you might have a particular point of view. And, you know, the other thing that I want to emphasize today is I'm really going to try, and I know we both are, Sue, to try to voice what people believe who really do feel, you know, on the, maybe they lean more towards the pro-life side of this issue, and why. And I think that far too often we don't try to understand alternative points of view, and that tends to be when we're on the extremes. And I don't think either of us, we're not on the extreme of either side of this issue.
No, I think that's why we decided to tackle this topic, is because neither one of us is an activist in the camp, so we were kind of hoping we could have a fear-free discussion, because neither one of us has a particular anything to gain by triumphing over the other. We just want to kind of get out there and talk about it.
And you know, this, and this is a show about being as fear-free as we can, so I guess that's appropriate. But I think, you know, one of the things that I've pondered even before talking about this topic openly is it really is a topic that personally, and I know I'm sure for a lot of women, it's a really challenging one to approach. And, you know, I've never personally had to face the prospect of, you know, having to make that choice. But, of course, many women, you have to think about what would you do in that situation. And I think that there are many nuances of this topic. I think far too often people think of, like, the young person who, you know, maybe someone in college making the choice. And, yes, there are many, many women in college in this situation. However, older women? Yeah, well, what about older women? Because as I get older, the topic changes for me, because I realize the risk of a pregnancy for someone my age would be much higher.
Sure.
And, you know, this isn't going to be a show, you know, I could have prepped with a whole bunch of statistics like an activist might, you know, and I didn't really. I mean, there were a couple articles in the paper that just caught my eye. Like, there was one just within the last couple of weeks about how women still die from pregnancy. And I guess it was in response to one of the candidates suggesting that women don't die in pregnancy and childbirth anymore. And that, you know, we've conquered that. Well, nothing is conquered 100% in medicine. I mean, that's a little bit unrealistic, but it certainly can happen. And I think, you know, someone my age, for example, with diabetes in my family, you know, that could be a huge risk. And, you know, they're just, again, there are nuances to this issue, the pro-choice side of the issue as to, and your age can really make a difference. You know, on the other end of this, if you're really young, I mean, obviously that's going to be an influence as well with the family. So depending on what their point of view is, of course.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting when I'm thinking through the challenges. And, of course, I was thinking, like you said, about the younger people. Let's just come out and say it. Everybody got in a big fluff over the guy who said, you know, if a woman gets raped and becomes pregnant, it's God's will, because normally women who are raped, their bodies sort of prevent them from being pregnant. And I'm not even going to go into whether that's true or not. I don't know, and I'll take the scientific word for it. But what he said, of course, really put a lot of people's backs out of shape. But the underlying thought of it was that that kind of underlies the Christian framework of looking at this, is that when you can't do anything about a situation, the healthiest way for a Christian to move through it is to say that God allowed it, and that, you know, and that with God's help, you will be able to walk through it, and that God is in the industry of redeeming horrible situations.
Yes.
And so, yes, I've heard some wonderful stories of women who have been raped, and their attitude in not terminating the pregnancy was that I'm going to take this horrible thing that was done to me, and I'm going to respond with life. And that life is going to redeem what's been done to me. But to say that everyone can go through that process, you know, and make that decision is highly unrealistic. No one should, you know, be a parent who isn't willing to take on that challenge, which, of course, is why the adoption, you know, business is on
right.
the table. But I guess what concerns me sometimes in the extreme pro-choice side of things is that sometimes I hear an echo of something that anyone who faces an unwanted pregnancy, we should make it as easy and comfortable as possible. In fact, you even used the word comfortable a little while ago, so I'm going to kind of jump on you for that. You know, like this is a hard decision, and I don't really think it should be made easy. I mean, people who are going through hard times, that's what makes us grow. That's unavoidable. We don't want to spare our children having to make hard moral choices. We want to teach them how to approach hard moral choices. And so even though I do want to treat this topic with grace and with mercy and with understanding that not everyone can meet the same challenges in the same way, I don't want to go completely off the board and say that we should make it easy for them.
You know, I guess where I see an issue in particular here is I honestly thought there was great promise to the introduction of the morning after pill, for example, or Plan B,
mm-hmm.
which has now promoted a whole different discussion of this topic of life beginning
yeah.
at conception. Now, that is a really serious area. I mean, I guess the thing is that I think that pregnancy is going to occur in this society. I mean, you just, I think that we should be responsible, but that unwanted pregnancies can occur. And
yes,
and the question is, well, there are multiple questions here. First of all, in fact, I think we better go right to this at the beginning, is it all has to do with when you believe and when society believes life begins. And, you know, I have been pondering this, and one of the things, and I'm going to just step away from abortion for a second here,
mm-hmm.
and contemplate how we determine laws in a society, in fact, any society. I really think that a society's laws tends to come out of whatever that society views as moral. So if a majority of people believe, for example, that murder is wrong, and let's take this away from abortion for a second, not
right.
even talking about it in that context. How
plain old garden variety
just
murder.
Plain old murder or theft. You know, let's talk about other crimes. Murder, theft. You know, when there tends to be agreement that, yes, that is wrong, that's part of the value, that those are value judgments that a society makes. Societies can make really different judgments. Like if you had lived in Mayan times or, you know, there were things that they considered right in that society that were horrible, you know, like
human
sacrifice.
Sacrifice.
Yes, yeah. That's what comes to mind. But in their society, that was noble. Well, of course, we view
yeah.
that as, you know, utterly wrong. But part of this has to do with, is our society shifting towards making the decision in a majority way that this is wrong? Now, what happens here is when the society's not really in agreement over something being morally wrong, that then leads to tremendous conflict. And in this case, it's even more so because you're talking about a woman's body. I mean, it's you know, obviously going through with a pregnancy is going to impact her life and potentially her health. Even if she does go the adoption route, it will have an impact on her. And, you know, originally this all was legislated, or, well, not legislated, but the reason abortion is legal right now under certain circumstances is due to a woman's right to privacy, which is interesting. It's a constant, it's under the 14th Amendment, actually, the Due Process Clause. Now, I did do a little research on this because I didn't even claim to be an expert on Roe versus Wade, Sue. I mean, again, most women aren't. Most women don't just go and know and research all these things. We don't.
Yeah, we just think, okay, Roe versus Wade, it's okay to have an abortion. That's
right,
that's
and of course
the
it
law.
Has a
that's
lot
what the
to
law
do.
Says or something.
Right, yeah. Well, and within limits. I mean, it really does say until viability. So I guess changing that part of the law is, or that part of the decision would be the key. I mean, if someone really were, if enough Supreme Court justices, and if our society were to really believe, enough people were to believe, such that people, officials are elected that support this, that then ends up getting a Supreme Court elected that supports this, that life begins at conception, well, then that would change everything. Because, you know, looking at the other side of this topic, and that's what I really wanted to do on this, is not demonize or create caricatures of even, you know, people who feel very, very passionate that abortion is simply murder. I mean, and they do. They feel very passionate about that. And that's something that I feel is going to be a little different about our discussion today, is that instead of either mocking or, you know, dismissing, as so often happens, I mean, I really feel that these people, they honestly, very sincerely feel that babies are dying. I mean, that's what
they
believe.
Well, yeah, there are pro-choice people who believe that it's kind of a conspiracy to rob women of the right to choose. And I have to agree with you that I have not seen that in any of the pro-life people that I'm friends with and have known for a long time. There is no sense of that. In fact, they feel in a way that it's taking away empowerment from women. Both ways you go can disempower women, whether you have an abortion or not. One of the things that I've often heard is that if you allow abortion, you totally let men off the hook. It's like they don't have to, all they have to do is tell their women, you know, oh, well, get an abortion, and then they, you know, they get the, what is it, getting the milk without buying the cow or whatever, which to me is extremely dismissive of women as well. And so anyway, what did you find when you looked at the actual what the law says as far as, are there already limits in place?
Well, viability and determining when viability is. And again, I didn't spend... It's pretty complicated to look at this, but the key is determining when a life is viable, even with artificial means. So that's part of it. And generally, that's considered 28 weeks. But I also read that can be in the range 24 to 28, but I don't know how that's actually handled in practice. So,
well, the thing I think we that we have to... You know, I want to hear what your experience is in rumbling over this when does life begin business in your head, because frankly, when I did it, it was, I just wanted to throw my hands up in the air and, you know, go play golf. You know, it was, because any time I found myself delving into it, I could make certain assumptions, or I could make certain, or I could leave certain gray areas. And if I did that and carried it through to how that could affect things legally, I did not like the world I saw on the other side. It was scary. On both, no matter which way I went at it. And And all I could walk away from is the fact that we don't have enough data to make absolute pronouncements on when a child is becomes a living being, and certainly not when it gains an immortal soul, which plenty of people don't believe even exists in the first place. What's ironic is that the people who believe that a life has an immortal soul are the ones who tend to be the most fundamentalist about not about that life not being destroyed. And yet they might be the ones that would believe, well, if it is destroyed, you're not really killing anything because it'll have a life beyond the flesh.
Yeah.
But not even getting into that. The point is, there's no way, I don't think, that we're ever going to come to agreement from our different worldviews on when life begins and what kind of value is placed on a fetus at different stages of conception. So the question is, how do we move forward together in a world where that cannot be agreed on? Is there a way to move forward?
And I
think there is. But I want to hear what you think.
Well, I think that's part of the problem that we have right now. And I'm hearing a little echo on the line. So what I'm going to do, see, this might kind of stilt our conversation just a little, but when I'm going to talk for a minute or something, I'm going to mute you, and then I'll bring you back on. I'm just going to see if it helps with our echo.
Okay.
Occasionally we get this, just a technical glitch, not much I can do about it, but I'm going to see if this helps. So just be prepared.
Okay.
All right. All right, responding to Sue's question, I believe that this is the most challenging thing of all. I mean, there's a real problem here in the sense that if a large group of people believe that right from the moment of conception, if you end a pregnancy, that is actually killing a living being, then it's going to be really challenging for someone who really seriously believes that way with all their heart, sincerely. Many of these people have prayed about it. They are very sincere, spiritual, religious people who truly have come to this conclusion. And so because they believe that so strongly, from that perspective, they're looking at the rights of the baby and not simply the rights of the mother. So that's where it gets challenging. Now, where I look at this personally, it's, and I'm sure I'm not alone among women, there's tremendous anguish in figuring out when life begins. I mean, for me, if I go all the way back to the beginning, at conception, that to me is solely in the realm of belief. If you say that life begins at conception, there is no scientific basis for that. That you would have to say that is coming from belief. So, for something to be legislated, there has to be a scientific basis for it, unless we really do choose to legislate our beliefs, unless, you know, we go a little more, not just a little, a lot more theocratic in our society and say, this is what we believe and this is going to be the law. I feel that would be much too harsh. And there are several reasons why. I mean, I've actually explored, people are running away from this issue, but several forms of birth control would probably need to be banned. Not to mention, we would start a whole new war on drugs when that happened, including on the morning after pill. Are we going to imprison women for, under any number of circumstances? Our prisons are already overflowing because this would be even worse because, have we really thought about the impact on our society? And is that the kind of society that we want to be legislating that kind of thing. If a woman has a miscarriage early in her pregnancy, I heard this down in one of the southern states, if a woman has a miscarriage during her pregnancy, is that going to then be examined to see if maybe it was murder? I mean, there are some really horrible, horrible scenarios that can come up here. And this is why this issue cannot be taken lightly, not at all. And I think that figuring out, you know, should we be examining viability and when it should be legal? I think that's something a society should, a responsible society should reexamine. Our science has changed, perhaps. You know, there may be more things we need to examine there that will help women know when, you know, when to make that choice. And some women will choose to continue with the pregnancy no matter what. And I don't know that a woman really knows what she's going to do until she's in that situation. But the point is that legislating religion onto her goes against everything that our society stands for. When it is a belief system, not anything that's coming through science. So I would be interested in hearing your response to that, Sue.
Well, I think you make a really, really good argument. Without doing a bunch of research that I haven't done, I can't speak to what science has discovered about, you know, whether there is any scientific way in which they can determine when life starts in a fetus, but I'm kind of assuming that that's how they're, you know, how do you define what's life? I mean, the minute it starts growing and having cells replicating, if that's life, then absolutely it starts pretty much right away, doesn't it? But if you're talking, you know, the law came into place to address viability, which is, could it live on its own outside the mother, with at least with some help? And anyway, those, yeah, once again, I can't find those definitions satisfying in any moral sense, because, you know, what we're doing is asking frightened people to make a moral choice based on something that they cannot make real to themselves, which is why you have, you know, pro-life activists out there showing, you know, photos of fetuses and aborted fetuses, and, you know, which they can take that way to the extreme, but what they're trying to do is get people to take this seriously as a living creature and not a blob of tissue. And so what I think what disturbed me when I started thinking about it was trying to say, are we protecting a life that already exists? Are we protecting a potential life? And if we start talking about potentials, then we do move into a scary world. You cannot, you know, give every potential human being a right to life. By that standard, of course, any time you don't have sex with a man, you're preventing a potential life. Yeah. And nobody wants to go there. So.
Well,
that's something we can agree on.
yeah, I think so.
But if you take it back with the, once again, trying to determine when a blob of tissue becomes life, that has, when it becomes a soul, when it becomes, starts to grow into a human being, whether you believe it has a soul or not, you know, I can't help but think that that probably happens, if it happens, how it happens, we don't know. But it would be consistent with the rest of creation to say that it probably happens on an emergent basis. It probably grows like the body grows, and like a flower grows, like anything else. And if that's the case, then once again, you cannot make a determination as to when that, you know, when it's okay to stop that process. So I almost want to know, is there a way we can move the discussion into a different place? Because we're never going to come to, we just don't, if we could admit on both sides that we don't have the tools to make that decision, how do we move forward from there?
And you know, the other thing that I wish we could admit is that there simply is not agreement in our society over something that is very major and very significant, and that it would actually be unethical for a one subgroup to enforce something over the rest. Now, I can hear the alternative argument already is that, however, people think that the baby's rights are being infringed upon, and that, you know, as long as we're denying that, you know, they feel strongly about it. But the fact of the matter is, I really feel that, and I don't think this is going to happen, quite honestly, but I feel that we would need to have a much stronger opinion, not, you know, 45 with people undecided on this, or, you know, shifting slightly in one direction. There would need to be a lot of agreement within society that this is simply morally wrong, and it's something that needs to be enforced. Because if we don't, and I don't believe we will, because there are really strong views on both sides, I think that there might be some support to examining, and I think far too often, you know, we're basing this all on 70s determinations. This was like 1973. Medical science has advanced a lot since then. I would be interested in somebody taking a serious examination of the whole viability principle, and when, you know, when does it make sense for this to be legal? However, bringing it all the way back to the point of conception, you're never going to get agreement on that, because it's a matter of perception. And I think that there would be such divisiveness with the nation so split on this. And it does have an effect on women. I mean, I do want to interject that here, is that I do feel, even though I think this isn't the main motivation behind the right to life movement, I do think there is a subtle undercurrent at times that, you know, women's choices aren't necessarily valued as much when you start getting particularly out towards the extremes, that, you know, a lot of people out there don't, you know, believe a woman should be home taking care of a family. And, you know, what's interesting is I chose both. I chose to be a career person and a stay-at-home mom, even though I, you know, I was raised conservatively, but that's not why I made that choice. And I know many women would consciously make the choice to stay home, although I found a way to make both work. But the thing is that there certainly is a subculture that generates a view of women that, you know, it's biblical, where they, you know, it's not quite, it's very strictly biblical. And I've certainly known women like that, especially in the Midwest, who are living in situations where, you know, they don't have the kind of freedom that many of us enjoy. So I think, you know, that's something that needs to be thought of. And, you know, if you don't have an option, you know, it is known that if you can't do family planning of any kind, like if this, we really do need to revisit the birth control topic. And if you can't do family planning, that greatly, not only, that has a lot of implications on society, and not just on women. So well, I would be curious.
I think I've said on this show before that I think one of the decisions women have to make in this new world where women are more empowered than they used to be, women who are of a more traditional faith need to take a serious look at what their options are when they decide to be a stay-at-home mom, because I think one of the most empowering things that has ever happened to women has been women getting out in the workforce. Because if every single woman had the ability to generate her own income, there would be so much more empowerment of a woman to make her own choices. And at this point, when a woman marries a man and agrees that he's going to be the breadwinner and she's going to stay home and take care of the house, the kids, that, you know, that's a wonderful choice. I don't want to denigrate it in any way. But there has to be a knowledge there that you've made yourself dependent on that man, that whether he stays with you or leaves you, you are still dependent on him. And it's going to limit the choices that you can make. And so you do find women being put in a position of having to consider that when they choose about an abortion. And one of the things I really want to get onto quick, because it's a super important topic for both sides of this issue, is the well, let's just talk about fear, since that's what this show is all about. When a topic gets this heated, when there's that much emotion, you know, we have learned now that when people get super emotional about things, it's always traced back to a fear. And if we are in a situation where we cannot come to agreement on these gray area topics, like when life begins, what we need to do instead is turn our eyes to the fear. What is the underlying fear of both sides, and how can we address that fear in a way that makes us able to move forward? So, you know, why do women get abortions? What are the fears that underlie those decisions? The fear of not being able to care for the child, the fear of the medical expenses, the fear of the risk to their health, the fear of upsetting their boyfriend, the fear of being rejected by their parents, by their religious communities. You know, look at all these fears. I'm just piling them up, and I haven't even talked to them all yet. So one of the things that the people who tend to be in the more moderate positions are saying is, don't take away a woman's right to choose, but instead take away her fear. And then you empower her to make really strong, responsible decisions. And so one of the big critiques of the pro-life movement has been, and I hear this all the time, has been, well, they care about the baby until it's born, and then they don't care about it anymore. All they want to do is make sure the kid gets born, but they don't care whether or not the mother has any ability to take care of this child, that you know, you can trace crime. One, like the Freakonomics show, actually did a show where they traced the reduction in crime rate back to the implementation of Roe versus Wade. And their theory was that by the time that all these aborted babies would have grown up to be teenagers and in their mid-20s, suddenly the crime rate is dropping. And they're making a very, very uncomfortable for pro-lifers premise there. Now, once again, I can't speak to the truth or falseness of this, but it does tie into that argument that pro-lifers only care about the baby until it's born. Now, first of all, that's a horribly blanket statement, and you cannot go across the board and say that. There are groups here in Portland that are doing fantastic work with pregnant mothers, getting them into medical care, getting them into housing, helping them find jobs, helping them reduce their fear so that they can make a good decision about whether they want to bring up the child or put it up for adoption. And those are the kind of things that give me hope that we can find a way to move forward. So maybe we could talk a bit more about the fears and how to address that.
Yeah. Again, Sue, I'm still kind of muting you because we're still having an echo. You're not muted when you're talking, but we're going to have to do this sort of like a CB radio conversation.
Understood.
I just want to make sure you realize I can't hear you when I'm talking. If I'm like monologuing, I'm just monologuing. And then I'll bring you in, because it's not intentional. I'll check to see why we're getting the echo. Actually, I haven't seen an echo in a while. It just every once in a while it happens. I don't know. Anyway, responding to this question, first of all, I think that although adoption many people see as an option, I'm going to look at this from a personal standpoint throughout my life, how I would have viewed that. And quite honestly, I would have been in terrible anguish to give up a child for adoption. Now, I know that many women can do it. I mean, if they have to do it, and maybe they get counseling such that it assists them with that. But to me, that's almost as much of an anguish decision. I mean, that would be really challenging. And then to go through life knowing that there's a child in the world, I mean, you know, having had a child, you really are attached to that child, and it would be challenging. So I'm going to raise that as an interesting issue I almost never hear discussed, is that it's not all that easy to give up a child for adoption once you've had it. And I'd be curious, and I don't know this, not being an activist in this area, I'm just talking based on what my own anguish as a woman might be. It is an anguishing decision any way you look at it. If you carry the baby to term and are not in a situation to raise a child, I mean, being a mother, I know that being a mother is a huge commitment. I mean, it's a many-year commitment. I mean, you don't even begin to conceive what a commitment it is to be a mother. And, you know, Sue, you raise a really good point about giving up one's career to be a stay-at-home mom. You know, although I managed to keep my career going at home, I gave up a tremendous amount. But I really felt I needed to be at home with my child who he had some things that needed extra support when he was young, and I felt that I needed to be there. And then I don't know how I got used to the idea, but I gave up a lot. I mean, my career was just going wonderfully well before that. I had a master's degree in computer science. I was rising quickly in leadership circles in my business where I was, and I mean, I gave up a lot to be a stay-at-home mom, even though I managed to keep my career at a simmer. And it kind of recovered, but in some ways it never really did. And even now, I'm still there for my child, who's a teen now and still needs support. And I still don't really regret that decision, but there are consequences of that decision. I mean, no doubt, financial consequences. He may not have as good of a college education because I made that decision, for example. I ended up getting divorced. That actually forced me back into the workplace, which I went fairly well, but it didn't last. You know, now I'm back at home working at home, and you know, that original decision to stay at home may have influenced that. So there's no question it has a huge influence, not only on your life, but yes, on your child's life too. And it's kind of a side decision, but again, I'm kind of monologuing here because it's sort of the way we're being forced to handle this show today. The other aspect of fear. Having been raised a conservative Christian, I know for a fact that from day one in college, the fear of the shame, the fear of shame, probably drives many conservative women. This is an interesting thing. Because the prospect of upsetting the family or even being shunned in some case, although I don't think that would have happened in my case, but it's just such a horribly anguishing prospect, the fear of the shame. And that's a word I really want to bring up because it comes up for conservative families, even an overall family. I mean, I don't want to suggests that this occurs, and I'm not saying it would have happened in my family, but I have heard of situations where sometimes even an entire family is shamed by this situation, and you know, it's a challenging situation, and I think we need to fix that. I think we need to stop making women fearful, and it's a whole culture surrounding the way we view sexuality and even forgiveness. It's that shame factor. And that needs, if you really want to help young women especially, that would be something to address. Okay.
I couldn't agree with you more about the shame, about the shame thing. As Christians, I'm not saying you and I, I'm just saying my community, we have a tendency to, you know, categorize sin, and there are some sins that are worse than others, and for some reason sexual sin is definitely, you know, one of the biggies, and it has more of a shame to it than other sins. And you know, you understand why people do that. It's intended to be a preventative. If you give, you know, these girls enough fear of the shame and the rejection, then maybe they won't, you know, go commit the sin or whatever. But we're seeing once again where that fear leads. And if we're trying to find a way to bring our children up to make good decisions, we need to address their fears and the shame. You know, we've got to do better at making our young women understand that we will still love them if they make mistakes, and we will still support them if they make mistakes.
Yes.
So that they, you know, I think that will make them stronger than trying to imbue them with this sense of shame that we hope will keep them on the right track. What do you think about that? I mean, do you think that's you know, sort of a bleeding heart way of looking at it, or do you think?
I think this is a very challenging issue that is, again, rarely addressed, is how many young women from conservative households, maybe they become less conservative. I mean, that's really common. Okay, getting the echo again, so I'm going to have to monologue this again. Bear with me. Hopefully it's working without. Okay. How many women have been shamed into getting an abortion? I mean, I can think of maybe one case that I'm aware of myself that could have occurred. And you know, if it happens to someone, they're probably not even going to want to talk about it because the shame is so great. And then just think of what that woman then has to live with alone, because that woman already comes from probably a very conservative background. And then maybe, you know, over time, it's not unusual for people to become more open-minded. I mean, I'm certainly more open-minded than I was back then. And but then what if something does happen where then they get pregnant and then they do have an abortion and it's a total disconnect with what they've been taught, and especially nowadays where there are even stronger arguments on the right to life side to make these women just you know, absolutely hate themselves, and they feel like they're trapped. That's the thing, is that we are making women feel like they're trapped, and it's because of the shame. And, you know, I think that is a very significant area, and it has to do with fear, absolute terror. I think a lot of women are terrified of their sexuality if they come from that conservative background. And, you know, there's another side of this I'd like to address. Just having become more open-minded over time is, you know, not everybody has the same view of sexuality. Just because in Christianity, or conservative Christianity anyway, you're raised a certain way with a certain viewpoint, there are many women who they shift in their thinking about sexuality. And you know, many people view sexuality as a very healthy part of life, including outside of marriage. So I think that, you know, that may be something that's very difficult for the conservative community to accept, but there certainly are many women and men in society today, again, showing the differing ideas within our society, who believe that this is not a sinful thing. It is a healthy part of life. While at the same time, I think there is a strong, here's something we all agree on, or most people agree on, that it should be very responsibly done, that you don't just, you know, if you're not prepared to have a child, if you're not trying to have a child even, you really need to be responsible about how you go about your sexuality. And so, you know, that's where we come into, boy, this just keeps going and going, you know, the type of education that you give young people. You know, do you teach abstinence? Do you teach them, well, what do you do if you decide to have sex? And I'm not talking about really young people. I don't believe in teenagers in high school having sex. I would discourage that, although I understand that there are reasons why, you know, if they make a mistake, they need to know what to do. So I actually see both sides of that. I don't think that we should not teach these kids birth control. I think nowadays, usually the parents can opt their kid out of that if they don't want it. I mean, I've seen that. So I don't think just encouraging, you know, young kids under 18 to have sex is a good thing. But I also think the responsibility is important. And as you go into adulthood, it's important throughout your life. I mean, you have to view this responsibly, even within marriage. Now, some people don't believe in birth control within marriage if they're very religious in that way. But a large number of people do believe in family planning, even just for the sole reason that how are you going to support that many kids? You know, I grew up in a time where there were some families on my block who had maybe 12 or 13 kids. You know, that could happen. And I know there are families like that today. And people should have the choice to do what they choose in that respect. But most people can't support that many kids. I mean, and, you know, they can have the choice to do that, but most people would choose not to have that many kids. I mean, that's just the way it is. So anyway, be curious how you respond to all of this, Sue.
Well, I took off my headset to see if that improved the echo. Once again, I couldn't agree with you more on the concept of responsibility. And when I'm talking about ways to move forward on these things we cannot agree about, that's one thing that if we could focus on more, I think we could move forward.
Yes.
I have pro-life and pro-choice people who the problem, I think, is always, as always, it's in the extremists, right? It's people who hold back good legislation because it doesn't give them everything they want. People who refuse to compromise because they say it's a moral issue and you don't compromise on murder, you can't compromise on this either. It's that kind of thing that keeps us from being able to move forward at all. Because, and I also hear people on the other side saying they don't want to acknowledge sometimes that responsibility needs to be a massive part of the equation, because then it sounds like they're giving away too much to the pro-lifers. You know, well, we don't want to think we're agreeing with them, so we don't even want to talk about that because that sounds too much like, you know, like there should be some kind of punishment for getting pregnant, and we don't believe in that. So if both sides could, you know, let go of some of that to come together and say one thing we both agree on, and that is that we have to be responsible for our sexual behavior, whether we agree on what's a sin and what isn't, and what kinds of sex are okay and what kinds are not, we're never going to agree on that. So don't worry about it. But what we do agree on is that we have to consider the consequences. Any kind of sexual behavior should be done with the idea of what's best for my partner and what's best for any life that might come out of this. And am I willing to take the risks? And am I going to follow through on whatever happens as a consequence? And if we imbue that in our children, we're going to reduce the need for abortions, which is, I think, where, you know, where the middle ground is, that we can find some firm ground on, even if we can't agree about the basic issues, is let's at least teach our children to be responsible, and let's address the fears of people so that they can come down off their emotional, you know, roller coaster and make good decisions. We need to address the issue of poverty. You know, this is a big, big factor in women having abortions. Now, I was watching back when Obama, at the very beginning of his time, when they did the debate at Saddleback Church, and Rick Warren was talking to them and brought up the question of how would you legislate on abortion. Now, they were talking at Saddleback Church. This was not a secular environment. And no matter what, how it was colored later by people on both sides of the issue, when Obama said, I will not legislate against abortion, what I want to do is create a world in which fewer abortions need to happen.
Yeah.
He got applause. He got a lot of applause.
Yeah, everybody agreed on that. That's right. And by the way, the echo's
gone. He didn't get
gone.
As much as, you know, maybe he didn't get as much as the guy who said abortion should be outlawed, you know. But
yeah. No, that's
but he
true,
did get a lot of applause.
Agreement. He still got, it was not, it was not received in a hostile way. So
no, not at all.
What you're saying. Because why wouldn't you want a world like that? I mean,
yeah, even if
you're
pro-choice, that doesn't mean you're pro-abortion. And we tend to stigmatize that with saying that just because you're pro-choice, it means, oh, yeah, let's go out and have abortions. Yay.
Well,
you know,
yeah, you know,
women really look forward to that.
It's not just that. There are risks to abortion. I mean, I know the pro-life
yes.
side uses that as a reason, you know, very dire warning thing, but there are risks to any medical procedure. So just as there are risks to pregnancy, which I don't think should be belittled either, there are certainly risks to abortion, and there are big side effects to the morning after pill too. And, you know, honestly, I would like to see us as a society even develop better birth control, because there are side effects to that too. You know, a lot of women who want to be responsible, especially as they get older, find themselves in a position where certain birth control methods don't really work for them without high risk. And so I feel that as a society, that's yet another area where we really should be focusing, you know, not just the same approaches to birth control, something totally new, some breakthrough approach that,
mm-hmm.
you know, doesn't have the side effects. Because, see, that's another part of this too, Sue, is that I've known multiple people, and I personally have experienced this in my life too, where like the pill ended up being something you couldn't tolerate anymore. That can happen. And, you know, if you take it for years and years and years, that can be a problem. And so why aren't we developing better birth control methods and not always based on the same approach? Also, the other thing with birth control, and by the way, it was the headset, Sue. In fact, that is something for me to note for future guests. Whenever we get an echo,
okay.
I just need to
good
ask,
to
do you have a headset? Well, I have a loud voice. I mean, I talk quite clearly and loudly into the phone, and I think it just echoes right back is what happens. So anyway, thank you for figuring that out. It makes it much easier to have a conversation. But it does. I mean, I didn't really like monologuing like that. But the thing is, I mean, we both kind of like to express our opinions well, that's for sure, but I like to have a little more interaction. Anyway, now I've lost my train of thought. But birth control. You know, the other thing I examined, in fact, this was something I was going to raise with the whole life begins at conception thing. I mean, I know people are trying to avoid this topic, and the major candidates are even saying, you know, I never said anything about birth control. But the problem is, this really is an issue. This is what happens when we race into legislating something without really studying it or put it in the courts, is it would impact several methods of birth control. Because based on, you know, my research, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but there certainly is debate over several methods of birth control, including all forms of hormonal birth control. That includes the pill, any kind of, you know, implant, anything that releases hormones to prevent pregnancy, or an implant like the IUD. One way that these things are thought to work, not the only way, But one way is by preventing the implantation of a fertilized egg. And I found it really interesting that that seems that I went to the Planned Parenthood site and I was really amazed that they were kind of belittling that. Then, but they really weren't even talking about it. And then I thought, well, of course they are, because they don't want people to stop using birth control. And even by mentioning it here, I endanger people, you know, suddenly they're going to stop using birth control. But the thing is, we can't shy away from these topics. We have to honestly face them. I did see Rachel Maddow give a very clear, with diagrams, description of this some months ago, where she said, here is how the pill works, you know. And I used to think it was the only way it worked, that it prevented implantation. But I'm wrong on that. It does a lot of things. It prevents ovulation and it does other things. It prevents fertilization to a point. But in any case, if there's any risk, again, if we're talking legal standards here, and if we say that life begins at conception in a legal way, all of the methods of birth control that could prevent a fertilized egg from implanting in the uterus would then have to be technically taken off the market. I mean, if that was the law, you couldn't risk that actually happened. And that would be, of course, that's a side effect that society would not accept. I mean, it would have huge impacts, including on Christian women. I'm sure there are many conservative Christian women who use birth control. And one more thing, and this is pretty out there, and I was amazed when I found it. Apparently, and I invite people to research this, breastfeeding, I hesitate to raise this, but I'm going to say it in a way, okay, God designed us with the ability to breastfeed a baby. Obviously, there was not formula before the modern age, so I am saying this not to diminish breastfeeding in any way. However, did you know, I always knew, I remember my doctor saying, when you're breastfeeding, you know, that has an impact on whether you can get pregnant again. I never knew, and I just happened to stumble across this, that breastfeeding, one of the things it does is prevent the implantation of a fertilized egg. And so I got to thinking about that, and I thought, oh my gosh, that means if you really were serious, I mean, if you were really serious, you're not going to not breastfeed. No, you would have to, in a marriage, tell your husband, we have to abstain from sex until I'm done breastfeeding this child. Because otherwise we're going to risk losing a baby.
An abortion.
Think about that. Think about that,
well,
too.
I'm glad you brought it up. It's a perfect example of the kind of thinking that can just stymie everyone, you know.
Yeah.
And it also brings up some of the fears on the pro-life side, that if you're pro-choice, you need to address these fears rather than just writing off the entire viewpoint. And, of course, one of the fear I'm speaking of is the fear that if we allow the fertilized egg to be anything less than a life, we are going to end up in a world where we get to make other choices to murder based on convenience or financial stability or whatever, rather than a moral choice. And so, you know, I hear that brought up all the time. Well, if you're going to allow a person to abort a child because they can't financially care for it, then you're going to have people who we're going to move into euthanasia, we're going to start killing old people, we're going to start killing disabled fetuses or, you know.
Yeah, they bring it to
all
extreme.
This stuff then comes on the table because the law tends to be pretty black and white, and if you legally allow something, people will use that law to justify all kinds of atrocities. So how do you address that fear that allowing women to make this choice isn't going to move our society more in the direction of those other things?
Well, you know, every way that I view this issue is that if we were to define life to begin at conception, it would have incredibly dark consequences on our society. I mean, the end consequence is not going to be a positive one. And, you know, I have to revisit this whole breastfeeding thing. I mean, this really floored me, Sue, because I got to thinking about it, because I thought, why doesn't it say, okay, if you're coming from a conservative biblical standpoint, as both of us were raised originally, and not to say too much about your background, but you came from a very conservative evangelical background, and you were even a worship leader in an evangelical church, I know, and, you know, I mean, that's why you founded Portland Christians with Questions, in order to evaluate challenging questions that, you know, you couldn't talk about in church. And I invite people to listen to some of the earlier shows that you and I have done. They're all on the frontierbeyondfear.com website, where you can kind of explore, you know, how do you deal with this when you're a Christian with questions. But here's a question for conservative Christians: is, if it's true, and I invite you to confirm this, please do. Please write comments on the page. As long as they're appropriate, I will delete extreme comments off the page, but I invite feedback on this. If indeed breastfeeding could prevent the implantation of a fertilized egg, why doesn't it say in the Bible that you should not have sex during that time? Because if this is such an incredible sin, if indeed life does begin at conception, why doesn't it say that in the Bible more explicitly? And especially in this case, the Bible has dictates for all kinds of behavior. Maybe it does say this in the Bible somewhere. I don't know. It says a lot of things in Leviticus and things. I may be really opening myself up to literalists, but it's certainly something to look at. I mean, you would think that would be a huge concern. And so I think that what we've done is we've taken it to an extreme. And it really is a problem, because we now have several people who are up for election who believe this way, that life begins at perception. I can't speak anymore. At conception.
Well,
and
if it starts at perception, we're really in trouble.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's another topic, too. We could talk about that. But you know, this is not something really to laugh about. I know I don't want to get too light about this, because this is really serious, folks. I mean, that's why we're having this conversation. And, you know, we can't just run away from these issues. We can't just avoid talking about the inconvenient topics around it. We can't just, you know, say, oh, this doesn't impact birth control, and yet the thing that's being talked about would impact birth control. And here's yet another thing. I mean, the body, you know, another thing, when you're an older woman, a lot of pregnancies don't go through. Well, people just say, well, that's just God's will or whatever, if they're conservative. But again, we really need to look at, you know, and it's in those early days when a lot of times women don't even know they're pregnant. In fact, I may have even had one of those situations I can think of where I wondered, this was years ago, actually when I was wanting to have a second child, where I thought maybe, you know, I had a situation where I thought maybe, you know, I had actually gotten pregnant, and then my body just got rid of it within a few weeks, you know, a couple weeks. And the thing is that happens pretty often. And, you know, are we making this definition just way too strict? And have we really thought it through what we're trying to enforce? And I say we, not really including myself, because I'm not trying to enforce this. But what are those who believe this sincerely really trying to enforce upon society? And what are the consequences? I mean, again, I revisit the war on drugs. What are the consequences? Are you really going to imprison women? I mean, you know that it won't stop the practice, especially now that there are things such as the morning after pill. There would be an incredible black market of that, unfortunately. I mean, it's just reality. Mm-hmm. And
yes,
this is the war on drugs in overdrive. And many people have said that doesn't work anyway, that the, many conservatives have even started to say that the war on drugs is not working. And so what are we going to do? Imprison even more people in our society? Only these people would be charged with murder. I mean, and again, the thing with the miscarriage, that is no joke. I read that, again, about some situation in the South. They were talking about a personhood amendment that was up for a vote. Can't remember where. I think it was Mississippi. And there was a discussion. What about a woman who has a miscarriage? Is she going to have to justify that she didn't cause it in some way? I mean, that puts an incredible burden on women and accusatory. We become like the Inquisition again.
Yeah.
And it's inappropriate. And so I guess in this sense, I really do need to pretty strongly come out and even sound like an activist, I suppose. I've been activistic in other ways, just not in this way, that enforcing a sub-portion of society, enforcing what is only can be viewed as a belief on everyone else is actually a theocratic thing to do and is not something that will succeed. It will only cause tremendous turmoil within society.
The problem, what I see as a, although I actually agree with you, I'll play devil's advocate here, or angel's advocate, whatever you want to call
it. That's why we're here.
Say that what I would see as a weakness in that article or that viewpoint is that you're basically saying that because of practical reasons, we cannot legislate something that is morally, if they decide that it's murder, which is what you're positing, is that, you know, if they decide that that's life begins at conception and it's murder, but because of practical considerations, we can't enforce that. And that's a non-starter. I mean, if it is murder, then you have no choice. That's, you know, it's wrong you have to stop it. It doesn't matter whether it's practical or not. It's a moral issue.
But the thing is, can I say one thing to that? Is that who designs that? We're back to this, how do we agree on what's moral? And in this particular case, there's not agreement within society, and that's when it's going to cause the most duress. In fact, I could even say in another sense, even the war on drugs, by legislating something that maybe shouldn't have been, because a lot of people apparently didn't think it was wrong. We've got a problem when we enforce something within society that a large portion of society, not just a subset, but a large portion does not feel is morally wrong. And so that's when there are real disconnects
but
in society.
Murder, there is agreement on.
Yeah, but what is murder is not agreement.
Yeah.
I mean, there is not
absolutely
an agreement.
Yeah.
If everyone could agree that yes, or a large majority, and you're having everyone to agree, that is murder, then that would result in a much different society because most people are not going to commit murder. And I guess, from a devil's advocate, again, my playing that is, again, why the right to life side of this tries to convince. And, you know, I think that they should be free to provide information. I think providing information is a good thing. I think that having as much information as possible is a good thing. Being afraid to look at information, and I think that can happen too on the right to life, on the choice side, is that you don't want to look. You know that feeling of I don't want to look. Now, forcing women to look, you know, I know that's been legislated in some states, and that's pretty controversial too. But I think, you know, personally, again, just taking this back, we can only look at it from ourselves sometimes. I would want to know. I mean, if I really were making that choice, I mean, I would probably evaluate as much information as I possibly could because, you know, you need – information is important. Now, going to the level, and I know I'm kind of – don't mean to hijack you too much here, Sue, but going to the level like what they're enforcing in, or talking about enforcing in some states – of the ultrasound that's intrusive, that to me is taking it too far. Because I actually know what those ultrasound sounds are like, having had a child.
I've had them too. Not fun.
And, yeah, they're not fun. And what if you were young? I mean, I can think of all kinds of situations where that would be akin to even torture if you were forced to do that. If you
Absolutely.
Were in a rape, if you had been raped, if you were very young and cannot easily accommodate that, that would be any other kind of, any number of medical situations you could be in where that would be not an appropriate thing to do. And just to mention, it's just not appropriate. It's not appropriate to enforce something that intrusive upon a woman. I mean, that's just not right. And so I do have issues with that. But on the other hand, I don't completely fault people for trying to get information out from their perspective. I don't think that's, we should never be afraid of information. We should be able to evaluate information. I know a lot of things are disputed. I had seen some stuff on the pain factor. That's an interesting area that I would study that. I know this has been disputed. And again, I'm not an expert on this, but I know that there are people who are saying that fetuses feel pain earlier than we think. And would that influence your decision if scientifically that could be proven that before viability there is pain? I mean, think about that one, Sue. And I'm not saying when this occurs or even if. I know that people very strongly believe that this does occur. And why would we be afraid to evaluate that? But you'd have to evaluate it with appropriate resources, I suppose. But it's a good question.
Well, I'd like to pop back for a second to what you were talking about earlier about the Bible and birth control.
Yeah, I'll let you talk for a while.
Well, I don't want to monologue either.
I just did big time, but go ahead.
But what interested me about that was that I do think it's something that the Christian community needs to, you know, deeply look into because, once again, the Christian community doesn't have a single viewpoint on this. Most
right.
of the evangelical communities I've been a part of do certainly practice birth control and don't have a problem with it. I would say that the Bible, as a general rule, is against birth control. It never comes out and says, you know, you will take a pill or whatever.
What,
it,
because of, like, be fruitful and multiply? Or
yeah.
I haven't studied this. But,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's kind of where I was going with it, is that the Bible is written through times when it was very, very necessary for these people to increase their population.
Right.
And for us to take that as a viewpoint that carries out through all of time in every situation is just hiding our heads in the sand. I just don't quite get how we justify taking those things and making them universal global constants. We're not in the same situation. We do need to reduce our numbers, and we have to do it in the ways that are available to us. And I'm unwilling to say that God did not foresee this and God did not, you know, that he really meant, he or she, I'm not going to get
mm-hmm.
gender specific on God, but that God did not think that when the Old Testament was written that we were expected to keep that mindset in a situation where population was not an issue. And, I mean, it is an issue, but in the opposite way. So I would like to see there be a bit more consensus reached in the Christian community
mm-hmm.
that times have changed. And usually there's a reluctance to address that I think is based more on that if we acknowledge that, then suddenly we are opening ourselves to acknowledging other topics that we don't wish to we don't wish to address. So we don't want to get started with that. But I think it's important because the thing we need to remember, especially as we're starting to run out of time here, is that no matter how you feel about what is and isn't a sin and what is and isn't the appropriate behavior for a woman in a unwanted pregnancy situation, there is forgiveness and there is grace offered to anyone at any stage in their life, no matter what they've done. And we have a hard time remembering that before the sin has been committed, you know. And so we'll put all this harshness into our preventative measures because we think that's what it takes for them to be effective. And then when the sin is sin, in air quotes, has already been committed, then we come in on the women with the word about grace and forgiveness. But it's too late by then. They've already been scarred, you know. And I just wonder if there's a better way. That's what I wonder.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that with discussions like this, we actually don't run out of time anymore, which is kind of cool, although we won't go on forever, but there's not a hard cutoff. There is for the live conversation, but we can keep going if we can make this stop when we feel like we're done. But, you know, I'm thinking about what it's like for so many conservative women, and if especially the young women, and including and the boys, let's not exclude them either. I mean, the best thing a parent could possibly do is to say, "I will love you no matter what." You know, it's okay to communicate values to kids, but you know, just like the prodigal son, that story, for example, in the Bible, is because I think that a lot of anguish over this topic, and probably a lot of abortions, unfortunately, occur because of that shame factor, because these kids don't know where to turn and they feel trapped. And you know, this is totally independent of maybe different communities that have different views of sexuality. Here I'm focusing upon that conservative Christian community where obviously sexuality would be viewed as very wrong. And, you know, a lot of times these kids, and by kids, usually they're college age. I mean, I'm sure they're high school. I mean, a lot of things happen in high school too. I hate to even know what occurs, although we have to have an awareness of that too, and I do too as a mother. I need to. But even just college age kids, where probably it's pretty rampant, where, you know, a kid goes off to college and something happens and, you know, they're so afraid that they won't be loved and accepted, and that becomes their primary motivation for getting an abortion in a mm-hmm. situation that. And if conservative families really want to avoid that, they need to come up with a better way of communicating to children messages about shame mm-hmm. and messages about fear and messages about love and forgiveness that, you know, that fundamental doctrine of Christianity, so many, some of the most popular ministers within Christianity, I've heard them talk about how imperfect we are. In fact, when I had, even within non-conservative Christian, within universalism, we talked, in fact, Kevin Miller and I were discussing that, you know, not being perfect. And, you know, a big aspect of Christianity is just that. We're not, you know, mm-hmm. admitting. And again, I'm speaking within that community, because in a second I want to address this outside that community for a second. But that love and forgiveness would go a very long way. But I also think people should not ever view this as easy. Giving up a child for adoption is not easy, and that too needs to be addressed. And, you know, people need to deal with things realistically. I'm not saying that no one should ever give up a baby for adoption. I'm just saying that I hope those who do are given the support and that it's acknowledged that that's not an easy thing. And there are a lot of people who probably would ultimately make the decision not to give the child up for adoption if they could, even if it would be difficult. And, you know, that needs to be a choice that's available to people as well.
Absolutely. That's why the poverty needs to be addressed.
Well, I've heard of situations, this is another topic altogether, where sometimes these girls are pressured into giving up a kid for adoption. And, you know, there can even be some things that sound off around what can occur in that area. And that needs to stop. Anything like that where someone's being mm-hmm. pressured to give a child up for adoption, that should never happen. But so, and I think that too often I hear that overly simplified, oh, just give the baby up for adoption. I don't know how many times I've heard that, you know, it's, oh, it's a simple solution. No, it's not that simple. Not, you know, having had a child myself, I mean, I would spend the rest of my life wondering about the child. I mean, you can't help it. This is not an easy solution. I mean, and you would have to, that has to be addressed too. It's not easy. So, and poverty, like you say, I mean, improving society overall is important. And I am going to let this show go slightly over because there is something, and I know I'm monologuing again. I'm really bad at that. There is one thing I felt I needed to address is because, you know, this show has a large audience. It has a very diverse audience. And there is another perspective on this that, you know, in my own belief system now, I mean, it has evolved. I actually believe that souls exist. I firmly believe in reincarnation. This is my belief. And there are many people mm-hmm. who do believe in reincarnation. And this is an example of why a belief system does influence your thinking on this topic, that that assuming that there's just one kind of belief system around how souls come into this world is naive. Because there are a lot of people in this country, and I'm one of them now, who believe in reincarnation. So what that means, and you have to be careful because this could be interpreted to devalue life, and it's not meant to. But the thing is I know that any soul coming into the world has multiple opportunities, you know. And so I think that really does influence some people's perspective because from a Christian perspective, you only get a chance to live once. That if there really is a soul attached to conception, and I'm not saying that that's true with reincarnation. I have no idea when a soul enters a body. I mean, I believe there is a point when a soul enters a body, which is essentially a shell for something that is much bigger than the body. But I do believe that souls exist before birth and will continue after and have many opportunities to live. And so the real question I would ask, and, you know, I would ask this with the father, were this to occur, is why does this baby want to be born to us? And what does this mean? And these questions get really complex, you know. I've heard people say that it could be so that you would evaluate this whole situation, you know, then that's the only reason. And or it could be they really do want to be born. I mean, I know this sounds way out there, but I think it's very important for people to know that there are definitely more and more people in our society today, certainly within the New Age community, but also within other communities as well, who believe in reincarnation. And that's why legislating based on a particular belief, if it's influencing that, can cause problems as well, because
it may not cause as many as you think, just because if you take it to its logical, to its conclusion, it kind of comes out in the wash. I mean, most Christians tend to have some sort of belief about what happens to children if they're killed. You know, they tend to believe that any child below the age of accountability is going to go straight to heaven if they get killed because they're innocent and they haven't had a chance to sin. So by that logic, any aborted child would go straight to heaven. So why on earth would you be against abortion if that's
so
what
that
you
would
believe,
be even
you know?
Better than living, I guess.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I hate to say that. That sounds horrible. But, I mean, you can
bring
any of these to an extreme.
I'm throwing it out there.
But,
if that's where you take it, then then it's ironic that, you know, that leads to a certain activism. So the question is, and that's why I said at the beginning of the show that I just threw up my hands in despair when I tried to attack it from the issue from that side, is because there's simply no way to determine if you are committing a crime against a soul, or if you're simply meaning that it has to wait for the next couple to get pregnant to slide down the hatch, or if it, you know, if it has any meaning at all. It's there's no way to determine. So if you, and it's the same problem happens if you try to assign value to the fetus. I heard a pro-life speaker the other day saying that just because she doesn't believe that a fetus has the full rights of a person doesn't mean that she believes the fetus has no value. And I wasn't sure what that meant.
So it's a degree.
That seemed to be, yeah, I don't know what that meant.
Well, you know,
if it's a life or it's not a life, or if it's a potential life, you know, you go in circles until your head is ready to explode.
Well, you know, in a way, I mean, I was wondering this. I mean, I don't think there's enough. This sounds, I know this might not come across as right, but it's a real question. I mean, again, this is asking honest questions. I hope the listener out there, and I know people will be listening to this show in the archives for a while, please, please try to understand where we're coming from with this topic, that we are really trying to be honest with our beliefs. And I hope that even if someone has a really strong viewpoint on this, that you can respect that we're actually talking about this so honestly, because that's our goal here, is to promote honest discussion. And, you know, one question I had is, if you took it to a logical conclusion, if you really believed that this was a baby, I mean, I know I've heard of this done very late in pregnancy. If someone loses a child very late in pregnancy, they often will bury the child and have a ceremony. If you really believe it, do people do that when they lose a child much? I mean, shouldn't you have a ceremony? Again, if you were a believer that this is life, and say a situation occurred where you had reason to believe you did have an early miscarriage, and that, you know, again, I mentioned earlier, I think that might have happened to me once. I'm not sure, although I guess since I wasn't sure, I wouldn't know, but it seemed it was possible some years ago. Would you then have a ceremony for that unborn child, because it's a baby that you lost?
Wow.
And I know. And if you're not having a ceremony, why not? I mean, the reason I ask this question is, how seriously do you take this? How seriously do you take this? Or are you really not taking it? When you talk about your friend who said it has some value, but not all the way, why aren't we having funerals for every time you have a miscarriage, even at 2 months? At 2 months, at 2 months, you would know. Actually, in my case, where it was suspicious, it was probably, I don't know, 6 weeks. I mean, something, you know, not getting to 2 months. I guess it's not that horrible, but I mean, just, you know, being late and never being late, and then having a very heavy, you know, period, and thinking, what is this? You know, could it be? And technically, this is for people to examine their hearts, what they really, truly believe. Do you really, truly believe that's a life? Because if so, there are a lot of funerals that need to be taking place. And I'm not saying this to mock anybody. I'm saying this, and I know it could be taken that way, and that's not my intent. I'm saying this to have people really think about how strongly they believe that this is a baby. And if the answer is that it's somewhere in between, then that needs to be examined. I mean, because we're talking about a proportion of society very strongly advocating for something that will have a huge impact on society, these personhood amendments. And, you know, I know another thing I was... go ahead.
Oh, it's just you raise such interesting pictures in my mind, not only in what you say about it helping you to define what your own true belief is, but also as a method of healing for women who've had abortions and are struggling with the guilt and the pain and the uncertainty. I mean, I just think that's kind of a beautiful thought, that if I... there's something almost Native American about it in the concept of, you know, if you are struggling with having had an abortion, and we all know funeral ceremonies are not really for the dead, they're for us that are still living to come to terms and to let go and say goodbye. And imagine having such a ceremony as a woman who's had an abortion to say, I'm sorry, I wasn't ready for you at this point. I couldn't be a mother for you. I'm sorry. And when the time comes that I can be a mother, I would welcome you with joy. You know, I don't know. There's something really kind of beautiful about
that.
Wow,
I didn't even really look at it that way. I mean, I was really looking. I mean, you know, I guess if you really viewed it that way, there really should be. And I think my question was also is why isn't that there? I mean, and to me, it indicates that there is ambivalence. And I know people don't like to admit it. I mean, I admit ambivalence a lot. In fact, in this conversation, I hope people understand I have admitted ambivalence. I certainly, I think that, you know, determining when abortion should be legal is one of the most difficult challenges we have. I mean, I don't think that's an easily answered thing. And you know, how far do you back it up? I mean, I know that some people will say, well, if there's any risk of it being murder at any point, then you can't risk it. Well, you can't really use that either, because that can really bring us to an extreme. And again, we don't have enough agreement in our society. You know, in a way, this is a problem we've got right now with, we have become very polarized. And I think it's really important. I'm going to take this, you know, with the election coming up. I think on any number of issues, and this one is particularly emotionally charged, but on any number of issues where there is significant differences of opinion, there are significant differences of opinion within our society, I think that our leaders actually have a responsibility to acknowledge that and steer towards the middle. Because otherwise, you know, steer towards finding solutions that are more about reconciliation. Because the more that we're on the extremes of issues and not acknowledging that there's another point of view, and this can go on both sides, the more the fabric of our society is really ripped asunder. I mean, and I think we're seeing that. Now, I'm not saying that we can't shift as a society in certain directions. I mean, a really good example is slavery. Look at how that divided the nation.
Absolutely.
And then we shifted. And there are many topics like that, I'm sure. And, you know, this may be one of them, that someday
I believe
find
it is.
A
this,
way.
And this issue and the homosexuality questions people have, those are issues that are churning us like a boiling pot and making us make decisions about who we're going to be. And I value that. That's a process that needs to happen, and it can't be easy. If it was, you know, it needs to be hard. And if we could kind of remember that when we're having our debates, maybe there could be a little more civility in the discussion.
Well, I mean, I guess there's one thing I need to say, and I'm playing devil's advocate in reverse in saying this, and this is a problem, you'll see what I mean, is on some of these issues, if it is your belief that the opposite point of view of yours is coming from the devil, and in this case, that may very well be the case, that people believe that the opposite point of view is demonic. Same thing with homosexuality, that they believe that it's evil. I'm not saying it's evil. Be very clear on this, that there are people who believe they see satanic influence. Then from their perspective, they don't see any way of making a compromise with satanic forces. Although there is an interesting comment in the chat that came up a little bit ago, and I'm actually going to mention it. We've actually had not a lot of involvement in the chat, but there is one comment that came up, and it sort of fits in here, which is kind of interesting. Listen to this. It came up earlier in our conversation. As a believer, I know that Satan is the adversary of this world. So as a believer, I must choose life. But I cannot choose this for someone who does not share my beliefs. I cannot take away their choice. It is a complex issue. Ponder that. As the conservative Christian, maybe there is a way to reconcile in a way. You know, so many times, Sue, I'm sure you've heard this many times, within Christianity, there's this concept of free will. That we have free will. We are not robots. We have free will. And I believe this outside the context of Christianity as well. But is that, of course, taken to an extreme, what does that mean? Do you let society just, you know, become a free-for-all? I'm not saying that. I mean, that's where it gets tricky, I guess, is how do you, I don't know, but this person in the chat found a way. Do you see that? This person in the chat said, as a believer, I know that Satan, this is before I even mentioned any of this about Satan, as a believer, I know that Satan is the adversary of this world, so as a believer, I must choose life. So, as a Christian, this person, a conservative Christian, I assume, has a decision that they feel they need to make personally. As a responsible believer, that's what this person feels. But, and again, quoting this person in the chat, I cannot choose this for someone who does not share my beliefs. I cannot take away their choice. And, you know, I think if this was totally independent of the mother and the woman, the fact that the woman is carrying the child, that makes it more complex than just a straight murder question, you know, like thou shalt not commit murder or says thou shalt not kill, and that gets really complicated because we actually do kill in a lot of scenarios, but I'm not going to get into that. But the thing is, assuming that, I think that, doesn't this become more complex, Sue, than most viewing of this type of issue? Now I'm losing my ability to express myself as we get to the end of the show, but
You can't remove this
from the choice of the woman. Is the problem? The woman is involved. I guess this is what I'm saying. I see this in this person's comment. There is a woman involved. There's not just one life involved in this. There are two. Actually, more than that, because the father's involved as well. You don't want to dismiss that. But the fact that the woman is carrying the child, this is why it becomes an issue of choice. It's different than other circumstances. So I sort of see this coming through this comment. So yes, please do respond, Steve.
Well, no, I think that's an illuminating comment, because in a way it's when we assume that we said earlier that everyone pretty much agrees that murder is wrong. And so we're able to legislate against that. And these are the clear issues. But where there isn't a strong consensus, then that's where we have to move away from legal responses and move into social and choice responses, so that if you strongly believe that it is murder to kill an unborn child, then your choices need to reflect that, but your laws don't. That's kind of what I'm hearing
well,
here.
Well, I think what they're
a possible
in a society
approach?
Where there's not consensus. I mean, I think that what I see in this is that this person acknowledges, and I think we can all acknowledge, there is not consensus, not even close, in our society that from conception, ending a pregnancy would be murder. There is not consensus. And the closer you get to conception, probably if you question people, the more likely there would be ambivalence on that. You know, and the farther away you get from conception, at some point, you know, see, that's where we find our level of agreement. That would be an interesting thing to explore, is if you had all the information. And here's where we have a problem, is that people really are afraid of the information. And I have seen this. And
yeah.
I think we don't want to see it. And I happen to come across, you know, just doing my research, I have to admit, I'm honest in this show. And, you know, I've run from some of the information. I'm going to be really honest here, is that I ran across some things, some imagery, some things that I found really disturbing online. And I'm not talking about, oh, someone's trying to shock me with this horrifying image, because that's often how it's demonized by the other side. I mean, there can be demonizations on both sides. It's like, why
Absolutely.
Are you showing me this horrible thing? And I know there are probably some cases where some things are contrived and there are dishonest things that occur, and I'm not even going to go there. However, there was one image in particular that stayed with me, and it was disconcerting. And really gave me pause for thought, because it's not an image necessarily I would go and seek out. Now, if I was in that situation where I had to make a choice, you know, and see, there's the other problem, is you shouldn't be in that situation. We should be prepared to act ahead of time, essentially. You know, I think we avoid it. There's a lot of avoidance in our society. Women don't even want to think about making that choice a lot of time. I mean, they're either anguishing over it or... You know, when they're in the situation, that's when they have to get the information. That's not the right time. You know,
no,
we should have the information
point.
Now. Because if I was in that situation, then I would be in terrible anguish. I mean, it would be the wrong time, really. It's almost too late. Because look at that. I mean, if you really believe that the longer you wait, the more it becomes life, you don't have a lot of time, you know, if that's really what you're believing. So... I don't think we should be afraid of information. Now, we need to be careful that it's accurate. There should be a discussion of accuracy. There are debates all over the internet on other topics. You know, one having nothing to do with abortion. GMOs right now, it's going back and forth, all kinds of studies conflicting each other, it has to do with genetically modified food. Totally independent discussion, but there is a healthy discussion going on. And yes, some of it is false claims, some of it are true, whatever, but at least there's a discussion. For some reason on this topic, it is so personal, people don't want to talk about it. The two sides don't want to talk, do you see? It's just not happening, and women are terrified to even look, because in a way there's this feeling of, I don't want to look at that, you know, and I know that
frustrates.
Well, as long
as I don't think about it, it's
painful.
Not a moral choice.
It's painful
yeah.
to look at those things. And the real question here is when do you make that determination that it's going to be, even within choice, Sue, each of us have to make our personal decisions. It's up to us. We are in a society of choice at this time. And if you're going to have choice, it needs to be responsible, and, you know, I would want to have the information to make an intelligent choice that I could live with, you know, and too often we delay it because it's such a painful thing to even contemplate.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some women it's easy. For some women, you know, even the woman in the chat, she knows as a believer she would choose life. Well, what about the women who are in that space of ambiguity? What about the women who aren't sure about taking the morning after pill? Well, you better have an idea, because you don't have a lot of time to take that. I mean,
yeah.
these are things you have to be prepared for. And And so I don't think we should be afraid of information and evaluating information, having an intelligent discussion on information. So let's see, how are we doing on time? But we're going to be, we'll probably end this at the 2-hour mark. I think that's what we'll do. We actually get a little extra time in the archive. We're no longer going out live, but the majority of listeners to this show are actually in the archive. And, you know, I really welcome all of them. It'll be interesting to see who ends up listening to this show. And, again, I do want to invite people, as long as they are appropriate, I will delete very extreme things that I feel are not appropriate. But if you feel that you need to comment on the show, do, because there is a mechanism to do that on the show page.
Yeah, I think we also want to say that both of us are in situations where this couldn't be an issue for us anymore.
Actually, that's
not
true for me.
Oh, is it? Okay, I thought you said earlier it was.
I'm getting older. I mean, almost not an issue, but I am not past menopause. So, yes, it could be an issue. Technically, I speak as an older woman, or late 40s, give my age away.
Yeah,
where
and I don't
happen,
have the equipment.
Unlike
so.
Okay, well, that's important, too, to say.
But the reason I brought that up was because I know it's going to be easy. I'll... Two reasons. One, I want people to understand that if I say something that is really offensive to you or seems unfeeling, that I am saying it from a space of safety, where I'm saying, well, I will never have to make this choice.
Yes.
And so to some that may seem that there's no value in anything that I would have to say on it because I'm not in danger. But the truth is there's a flip side to that, and that is that there may be some value in what I'm saying simply because I am in a place of safety.
Well, that's true.
It puts me outside of that's why I can address the question without fear, because I don't have to face that fear. And it doesn't put me in a superior position, but it puts me in a place where I can give a different viewpoint maybe than someone who is in imminent danger of having to face a real-world example.
Right.
Of
no, that's important. And, you know, and again, like for me, it would be unlikely at my age, but not impossible. I mean, I'm still... I mean, and actually, I think I brought that up at the beginning of the show, that it is important to consider older women and the things that they face if they were to get pregnant versus, because, you know, you stay fertile quite old. And that, you know, assuming that something doesn't interrupt that, but you know, so that is part of this whole issue. And I think it's helpful for me, because I was raised so conservatively, it's really easy for me to be very present within the college-aged, younger Susan persona, who would have been terrified. I mean, just utterly terrified. The worst possible thing to get pregnant, you know, because of the shame. You know, and just having to announce that to various people in my life at the time. And, you know, honestly, for conservative women, that can last most of their lives. And, you know, actually, depending on how they view sexuality as they get older, if that evolves, it can actually hinder your sexuality, which I should bring a whole guest on that one. But that's a whole different ballgame. But it is something, you know, it's that stigma attached. Now, when you're married, of course, it's a different situation. But, you know, here I speak as someone I can think of before I was married. I could think of, you know, even within the context of a marriage, you know, if you're having health issues or something, I can think of that time in my life. And I can think of now, you know, as an older, I am divorced. I am a divorced woman now. So in a relationship. And so, you know, there are all different seasons of our lives, and each one of them is influenced. And our background, we do carry it throughout our lives. And, you know, this has been a tough topic for me in my life. And, in many ways, I'm grateful I didn't have to face it. You know, now it is pretty unlikely, but it's a challenging topic, and coming from a conservative background, even more challenging, really.
I've known women who've had to face this and who've made incredibly heroic choices that I honor so deeply, and I would never want anything I say on either side of the equation to minimize the choices. Like I said,
yeah.
I don't think this should be an easy decision. I think it gives you a chance to delve to the bottom of who you are and what you value in life. And so if you're listening to this show, the thing I would encourage you most in especially if you find yourself very passionately on one side or another of the issue, is to look at the other side and really say, instead of saying, you know, whatever it is they're afraid of is stupid, it's an unrealistic fear, think about how can we address these fears so that they are reduced, and then maybe we can find a way to move forward.
Right. And how
just
can
really
we
want
help
to see that
other.
Happen.
Yeah, how can we help each other with the anguished ambiguity? I mean, that's the best way I can.
Yeah.
I mean, anguished ambiguity, acknowledge that
it should
it
have
exists.
Been the title of this show.
Maybe, well, I can change it. But because and acknowledge that it exists. And I know there's a certain approach that many take, you know, one way or another, and maybe that approach
yeah.
isn't working, you know, and what can you do to have the dialogues that you really want to have? I mean, that's really what this show is all about. It's having dialogues take place that often don't take place. And that's what we're lacking in society right now is, you know, people are just running from meaningful dialogue on this issue. It seems like it's not something that's being discussed in a way that really would lead to a productive outcome, at least some progress in an outcome. And so I think conversations like this are really important. And so I guess we could have added to the mix someone, you know, on the either extreme, you know, and see what that would have done. It would have probably been a pretty diverse discussion.
Yeah, it would have been a different discussion.
Ultimately, you know, those people need to come together too, quite honestly. I mean, I think that if we can't start talking to each other about any number of things, I mean, you can't make any real progress there. But anyway, I know we can wrap this up at any time, but we probably shouldn't let it go forever. No one will listen to it. They'll be afraid of it because it'll be so long.
No, I think mostly if people on the extremes can acknowledge, I think that would be a big step forward for them, for people on the extremes to simply acknowledge that there is ambiguity.
And it's often anguished ambiguity.
Yeah, it's something that is often denied by people on the extremes. Well, there is no ambiguity. It's murder. Or there is no ambiguity. A woman has the right to choose. That's kind of what keeps us from moving forward. If there wasn't ambiguity, there wouldn't be a question.
Right.
We wouldn't be all
exactly.
upset about it.
It's absolutely true. Well, I want to thank you, Sue. As usual, we had another amazing discussion, and we always seem to talk for 2 hours, by the way. It seems to be our natural course. We have no lack for words between us. But I'm really glad to have you on the show again, and, you know, I hope to have you on in the future again. We'll come up with another good topic. There's no end of topics to explore, no doubt. I really do welcome you, and I think we really have some powerful conversations together that we're both happy to share with those who are listening.
Thanks so much.
Well, with that said, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up, and I'm going to just note a couple of upcoming things. First of all, I'm going to be speaking tomorrow in Portland. I'm going to be at the Oregon Convention Center on Saturday, November 3rd, speaking on Embracing the Shift at 11 a.m. So if you'd like to come out, the seminar is free with admission to the expo. And then also on Sunday at 1 p.m., I'm going to be speaking on the Prophetess Legacy, which is actually quite a diverse conversation on prophetesses throughout history. Both of these talks, actually, even though the overall expo, I know this is a diverse audience listening in Portland, it is a New Age-oriented expo, although the fascinating thing is I don't necessarily, as much as Sue is a Christian with questions, I'm often a New Ager with questions, and I use that term very loosely, New Ager. So anyway, I just wanted to let anyone who happens to be in the area who would like to come out, just let you know that I will be there. I'll also be at a booth talking to people, booth number 18 at the expo. And then next week's show, I will have on Paul Levy. He is local to Portland, and we are going to explore mystical experiences some more. He has written a lot about mystical experiences and how they are often misinterpreted, and he's going to talk about that next week on this show. That will be Friday, November 9th, a little bit later showtime. That day, it'll be 1 p.m. Pacific, we'll be starting the show. So thank you again for being here. And again, I hope everyone can value the opportunities for dialogue that we have. And that is always my goal, whether in an in-person appearance like this weekend, where, you know, there can be open discussion of things from different viewpoints, and on this show. So thank you again for being here. Mm-hmm.